right, welcome. Welcome to presentation of PyTorin. I'm Stefan Müller, and I'd like to show you our semi-automatic polarization framework for astronomy data processing. This project is really a result of a very close collaboration with several astronomy projects, and it addresses the challenges that we experienced while working in those projects. These projects include, among others, the Reshi spacecraft, which is still operational, for which Gustavo Alonso from ETH has done systems research. We also have an astronomer on board with Adam Amara, also from ETH, who brought in experience from countless projects. Then there's the Solar Orbiter. One of its instruments is developed at the University of Applied Science, Northwestern Switzerland, in order to Chillagas Institute. And I'm a technical collaborator of the Dark Energy Survey in the team that processes the raw data from a 4-meter telescope on a mountaintop in Chile into science-ready data products. And I also helped in Euclid in the early design and prototyping of the data pipeline. So in all those projects, it becomes pretty clear that astronomers really like to work with Python code. They have really good numeric library support, they have really good plotting code, and that allows them to very quickly come up with their algorithms and their implementations. What we do with PyTorin is we take that sequential single-threaded Python code and we automatically parallelize it so that it can be run on parallel infrastructure such as the cloud, private clusters, or just the multiple cores on the workstation of the scientist. And once we have the result, we send them back to the workstation so that the scientists can study those. Now, automatic parallelization is a very well-known problem. It has been studied extensively, and it's very hard. So what we do is a simplified form of it, where we do need some support of the developer. That's why we call it semi-automatic parallelization. So in this talk, I would first like to give you a bit of an idea how designing systems for the astronomy community is different from designing systems for, say, a commercial environment. Then I would like to show you how PyTorin is used, actually, from the perspective of the scientist, how it works internally, and, of course, show some of the results. So why don't astronomers just use, say, MapReduce? Why do we have to treat them differently? Well, it really boils down to economies of scale, or rather, the lack thereof. Take, for example, the numbers of users. When we have a commercial system, we expect several thousands of deployments of the system software that we wrote, and we design them to scale to millions and millions of users. However, in astronomy, there's typically only a single deployment because there's only a single satellite of created per mission. And while there might be hundreds of researchers in such a big mission, the actual number of people that really touch the data, really run job, is very small. For example, in the Dark Energy Survey, there may be 5-6 people that really process the raw data. And then it goes to the individual science groups, and they have maybe 1 or 2 PhD students that actually do the number crunching to process it further. So we have a small number of users that yet process petabytes of data. And we cannot just take a system and say, yeah, we get more scale because we want to use it across several projects, because those projects are very individual. Astronomy specifically goes through a very innovative phase at the moment. There's a lot of new ideas around, and that leads to very new instruments that have never been seen before. The experiments are very, very new, and they just come up with new ideas. And on the technical side, that means we get data types that we haven't seen before. They're using pixel data, they're using spectrum data, graph data, combinations of which, and they come up with new things, right? The data volume is growing very, very quickly. The data processing is always very specific to the instrument because it has to remove those instrument effects. The actual data analysis depends on the questions the astronomer asks, and of course in each new mission they ask a completely different set of questions that have never been asked before. Altogether, this means that we cannot really expect a high degree of code usability in systems across such projects. Another big issue is that code changes all the time. And we know this loop. We have an idea, we create code for it, we run our unit tests on it, we look at the results, and we iterate till we're happy with the results, at which point we release the software and hopefully money starts flowing in. Now, astronomers happen to work exactly in this loop. So they have an idea of data processing, of an analysis they would like to do. Then they like to write their sequential Python scripts for it. They run it, but now it's not a unit test. Now it's on petabytes of data. And then they look at the plots and graphs that come out of it, and they iterate till they have finished their development. So really, astronomers are more like developers and less like users in a traditional sense of, say, a database system. And once they're finished and they're happy with the results, what they do is they write a paper, and because of code reusability, they probably never run it again. So all the time is really spent inside this loop. And astronomers, they are paid to have ideas, they are paid to study the results, they're definitely not paid to write code, and clearly they don't want to spend too much time actually looking at the progress bar. So when we want to design a system for them, what we have to optimize for is not just to reduce the execution time, but really have to consider that for every run there will be significant code changes, and we have to reduce the sum of the execution time and the time it needs to actually modify the software. So when astronomers can choose how they want to work, they really like those sequential Python scripts. It allows them to work independently and write their code pretty quickly. The problem is, when we run that on a large data set, it just gets prohibitively long. And of course, they know that. That's why for many problems, they have to write parallel code that scales to thousands of CPU cores and gets the runtime down to a reasonable amount. But now they have to spend considerably more time coding. They might have to code all their algorithms C++ with MPI, or they might have to take their highly complicated numerical algorithm and squeeze it into a MapReduce pattern. And the astronomers can't afford to spend so much of their time coding, so they have to hire software developers to do it for them, and now they have to spend time explaining this to the software developer. And I'm in this role of the software developer, so I can tell you that this communication is far from trivial. And even in a team that is used to work together, has worked together for years, such an iteration takes at least a week. And that's just not very efficient. That's exactly what we try to address with Python. So with Python, we take that sequential Python code. We have to slightly extend it because it's only semi-automatic, so we need some help, but it's very little. And then we can run it on thousands of cores. Of course, we'll never get the performance of a hand-optimized C++ solution, but even when we are off by factors in the performance, we're still faster in total, because we can reduce that large overhead that is introduced by writing parallel code and the communication between the developers. So how is Python used from the perspective of the scientists? In all those projects we looked at, we see very common patterns. That is, there are a couple of big methods that do the overall orchestration of the process. For example, in this little code here from the dark energy survey, they loop over the raw images. They do some bias and flat measurements on those raw images, use those to calibrate them, and then collect those intermediate results. And the actual number crunching is done into separate methods, which then contains all the numerics code for it. When we want to parallelize this with Python, we only have to add two types of decorators. And there's one called the schedule decorator, and this tells our Python system that this is the method that you should parallelize, that's the code you should analyze and try to split it up. And the other one is the functional decorator, which tells Python that this function doesn't do anything nasty, just as like writing to global variables. And that's it. That's the complete API of Python. That's all you have to do to parallelize it. And then you just run it. You run it with your regular Python interpreter, say out of Eclipse or whatever you like to use. And once the interpreter reaches that call to that schedule function, Python becomes active. And say you've configured it for the cloud, it will start up automatically the cloud node, say an EC2 for you. It will start Python interpreters there. It will transfer the code from your laptop over to those nodes, including in many cases the libraries. It will run the tasks on those nodes, collect the results, send them back to your workstation, shut everything down, clean everything up, and then that schedule annotated function will return, and it will return with the same return value as if you would have executed Python locally with just regular Python code. So we tried this on a machine learning example using random forests. Those are very easy to parallelize because you can train each tree individually. And the actual training is implemented in the SciPy library. That's a Python library that's implemented in native code for performance, which is something Python supports without any issues. And you can see that with just regular Python code, It takes about 3 hours to execute. That's the dotted line on the top. And it doesn't profit at all from several cores because it's just single-threaded code. And then we use PyTorrent on it. It actually scales nearly linearly down to about 4 minutes. And as you can see, for one core, the overhead for PyTorrent is really negligible on that scale. We also tried it on a private cluster with 16 nodes. There's 8 cores per node, so it's 128 cores in total, and we got the execution time down further to about 2 minutes. So it scales pretty nicely. So how does PyTorrent work actually internally? Well, when it sees that code with that schedule annotation on top, first thing it does, it translates it into a data flow graph representation. And this is really quite straightforward. Expressions in the code become task nodes, variables become value nodes. We use static single assignment form and you have several assignments of the same variable. And statements just as this for loop here actually become one big task node, and then inside that task node there's a subgraph stored which contains the statements that are executed within the loop. And we can translate the complete Python language, so we have ways to translate exception handling, the yield statement, so we cover the complete language specification, which is really important for us. Even though it's a relatively simple data flow graph representation, they have a couple of challenges. One thing is data-dependent control flow. The data flow graph typically doesn't have an easy way to represent changes in the control flow. We have no static type information available in Python Pacific. It's a very dynamic language. That means we don't know the invoked functions, which means we don't know the decorators, which is a problem because we need to know if there's this functional decorator to actually make any reasonable analysis on it. And we tackle those challenges of a dynamic language by using a dynamic data flow graph. So at runtime, as we evaluate through that graph, we learn about the values that are stored inside those nodes, and we use that information to dynamically adapt and refine the data flow graph to make use of this information. For example, we can change the graph for data-dependent control flow, and we can use now dynamic type information for the actual objects where we lack static information. We can, of course, detect those function decorators, and it opens up a large room for optimizations, for example, to adaptively refine the granularity at which we parallelize. So let me make an example with a very small piece of code that is nevertheless not quite trivial. So if you look at this little while loop, you'll recognize there is this x equals g of x statement in it, which essentially forces sequential execution. You also see that the condition of the while loop depends on data which is changed within the loop. And then we have the summation at the end, and because the plus operator might be overloaded, we cannot make any aggregate assumptions on that operation either. So when you first translate that, the whole while loop becomes one big task node. And as you can see on the left, the condition that fcall actually becomes an input to that big task. And inside is the data flow graph for the two statements. And you can also see that there's a peculiar second while task inside that subgraph. And that's the exact same task. So what we do is we use a tail recursive pattern here. So that inner while task represents the second and following iterations. And as you can see, it again has the f call as an input for the condition of the second iteration. So when we execute that, eventually we'll learn the value of x. Then we can call the f function. And when that evaluates to true, then we can do this dynamic graph change. We actually replace that whole while task by its subgraph, because we now know the iteration will be executed. And we can continue to evaluate till we know the condition of the second iteration. And at that point, we can expand that task node, which of course has the exact same data flow graph in it. And that way, the graph grows and grows, and we can execute it further. If we do that about 3 times and simplify the graph a little bit, then we get to this pattern here. So we have replaced the while task 3 times, so we get the 3 G calls of the 3 iterations, we get the 3H calls in the middle, and we get the summation at the bottom. And of course, we still have the tail for the fourth and following iterations. So if we assume that the G and F calls are very fast, say they're just an iterator and a simple criterion, then those functions will execute pretty quickly. And I've marked the ones that are running with the red border. And then the f function will execute pretty quickly too. And then we can expand the next while iteration. And we can grow that graph in VIF very quickly and expand it. And as you can see in the middle, we can now execute all the H calls of all those iterations in parallel. So even that little code doesn't really look like you could parallelize it very well, we can actually get a lot of parallelization out of it. But what if G isn't that faster function? What if it does some real number crunching? Well, then we can still get some parallelization. That means that the H call will eventually finish before the G call, and now we can run the G function of the third iteration in parallel with the H function of the second iteration and the summation of the first iteration. So we're now running three iterations in parallel. And this would be quite hard to do, even for an experienced programmer, to do this manually in, say, MPI, to actually code this, especially if it should be adaptive as we have it here and react to the actual execution time of the tasks. Yet with a simple model we have in Python, we can handle this quite well. And of course, we can do all the easier things like for loops and so on as well. So let me show you some more results. So we tried this on an exoplanet detection code written at the Institute of Astronomy at ETH. That's a Python code that was written before Python was even invented. So it's a code that wasn't designed for parallelism at all. And when you just run it in a regular Python, it takes about 8.5 hours to complete. Then we took that code and we added those Python annotations. We had to make some minor code changes so that the code matched the requirements for the functional annotation. And within minutes, we could parallelize it. And we tried it on EC2 with up to 62 nodes. And we actually managed to get it down to about 20 minutes. Again, it scaled very nicely. And for the astronomers, that's a huge deal. With 8 hours, that means they can only do, at best, one iteration a day. And it's still not long enough to really justify to go to the software developer and have him do it in C++. And with Python, they can now do 8 iterations in the morning, 8 in the afternoon. It's very unlikely that they're still bound by execution time. It's more likely that they're really bound by the time they need to analyze the results and come up with ideas how they can improve their algorithm. So our system at the moment, let me talk a bit about overheads. So we measured the overheads while doing that, and we saw that it takes about a second to do those dynamic graph changes and about 7 or 8 seconds to actually do the data communication. That 7 or 8 seconds does not include actually sending the payload, the science data around, because that goes over a shared file system. Not because we need a shared file system, but that existing code was using a shared file system, and we actually found that Python can very easily support that. So that's just the overhead of the bookkeeping of Python itself. So clearly, we're not in the business of taking something that takes 1 second to execute and make it execute in 1 millisecond. We are really in something that takes hours or days and scale that down. So at the moment, Python is still in its early phase. It's quite young, and several of its components have large room for further optimizations. We use a very trivial scheduling algorithm. For example, the one for CL we could use, which is far more advanced. We could make you far more of those data-specific optimizations. We could use prefetching to hide the data transfer latencies. We could do dynamic resource allocations. And we haven't done that. And even though our system is really small and simple in those respects, we can already show that it really massively lowers the difficulty, the boundary that they have to get over to actually use parallel infrastructure. It makes it far more easier for the astronomers to access cloud infrastructures or grid infrastructure, cluster infrastructures. And the key is really that non-intrusiveness and low learning curve in this environment is actually more important than to get every last millisecond of execution time out, because we have to consider also the time it needs to maintain that code. All right, and now I'm happy to take your questions.
Hey, Brad Moore, EHP Labs. So this is totally awesome, right? You're actually improving the productivity of someone who's not a computer scientist by doing some awesome computer science. Great job.
Thanks.
I want this. I want to play with it. I want to use it. Where does Pydron fail? Where is it that when you tried to do this, graph-based decomposition, automatic parallelization, it just doesn't work, or it works very poorly? I have another question, too.
Yeah, of course we cannot parallelize everything. I mean, the algorithms that are just inherently sequential. Another limitation is that a system is really designed for coarse-granular parallelization. So you need to have the individual tasks that run several seconds, better in minutes, to actually make really use of it. And another limitation is mutable changes. We have this functional pattern, so we're not really well designed for supporting algorithms that inherently need mutable state. So that's something we want to look at in the future.
And can you just compare it to TBB, Intel Thread Building Blocks? The Silk-based C++ parallelized, auto-parallelization, task-based parallelization thing?
I think I've looked at it. I'm not sure if I really have the right thing in mind. Is that the one that requires special data types to be used, special array data types?
We can take it offline.
All right, yeah. There's so many of those.
Yeah. Hi, Stefan. Hi. From Google. Can we go back to the example that showed the images?
Which one? Are you?
The example with the ad schedule on the loop on images.
I think I know what you mean. Yeah. That one?
Yeah. So the images here, are we talking about, are they effectively files? Is that what's going on here?
In this particular case, because this is based on the existing framework they have, right, and just try to port it as easy as possible, they're actually storing paths, file names in there.
Yes. So I guess my question is, for data sets that are very large, are we effectively assuming that we will talk about them in terms of files somewhere? Because obviously you're going to be limited by what you can take into a single box, right?
Yeah, well, to a certain degree, there's always the limitation of data transfer versus computation as soon as you start to parallelize. And Python at the moment is certainly quite weak because what it does, it uses the Python serialization called Pickle to serialize those objects and then just sends it around over a TCP connection. So there's a lot of room for optimization. And of course, we could do that better. And I think the main reason why most of the applications use shared file system is not so much because it's a really technical limitation, but because that's how they used to work in the last 20 years. So we think it needs both technical solutions and sort of a change of mind. Yeah.
Thank you. This is amazing work.
Thanks.
Hi, Scott Moore from Harvard. I was wondering if you guys have looked at trying to validate the functional annotations as you go along. Is that something you could maybe do with the graph updates?
We could certainly do some degree of validation. I mean, do it, you know, covering all the cases will probably be very difficult. At the moment, we don't do any checks at all, but I think there will be many checks that we could do. It would be certainly very helpful for the developers to find bugs, yes.
Cool. Very cool stuff.
Thanks.
Hello, I'm Omid from Stanford University. Great presentation and work. So correct me if I'm wrong. I guess the implicit assumption here is that each of these functions, if you parallelize it, the function could run independent of the other partitions. Is that right?
That's right. One of the conditions to be allowed to place the function annotation is that you don't have any side effects as changing state that is not part of the input-output pattern.
So, for example, would it work if I have a function like a stencil that you need neighbor values? Because without any annotation, you don't know the exchange pattern.
You would actually have to pass those values as parameters to make it really work. So you would have to pass the neighbors as parameters to the function.
So do you have any example application that does that?
Well, we always pass the values functions, but we don't have any concrete examples with stencils that tend to be more fine granular parallelization that we do here.
Yeah. Thank you.